Hey, it's me, it's Bob, and it's the show that is titled Bob Saget's Here for You, talking in third person, which is uncomfortable. I have a guest today who I just think the world of, Brian Regan, one of the best stand-up comics that exists in our world. And he's just a universally special guy. And he does what comedians are supposed to do, which is speak for everybody. It excludes no one, no matter who you are, really. That's my opinion and a lot of other people's opinions. He's so great. He's played Radio City and Carnegie Hall and toured the country and lots of the world. And he's an actor as well, recently in a Peter Farrelly series. And he's just incredibly talented and incredibly prolific. So we're about to admit him into the Zoom room. And in the meantime, I must tell you to do what you do with this show. You rate and review it, but subscribe. Rate and review it nicely. I'm a very sensitive dude, but I take notes. I do. Because I'm always trying to better myself, right? No, I'm always trying to butter myself. And the other thing you can do is follow this. And you can also call that number up top, and I'll be calling people, and I'll let you know on Twitter or Instagram stories when I'll be calling you guys and see how you're doing. This is a really incredible craftsman of stand-up comedy and just one of the people that I look to as one of the best. So here we are. I'm welcoming Brian Regan. Thanks for doing this.
Of course. Thank you.
You know how I feel about you. It's purely physical. So where are you? Where are you now?
I'm in my home in Las Vegas.
And that is good, right? You love it there, right?
Yes. I've been here 18 years now. And
you mean you've been in quarantine that long?
I've been in quarantine for 18 years. I was O.J. Simpson's cellmate for a few years out here.
Top or bottom bunk?
We'd flip back and forth. Wherever he wanted to be, I would go, yeah, well, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that's the fine. Heisman.
I've actually seen him a few times out here. He lives here in Las Vegas, right. And he hits the nightclubs. You know me, I'm a big nightclub guy.
Oh my God, you've been partying forever.
I'm just Mr. Party. And right. So I was in a club. It sounds weird. I'm in a bar, you know. A club doesn't. I feel weird saying I was in a club like I'm 25 years old.
Well, it's you just walking around.
And
go ahead.
He walked behind me and put his hand on my back, you know, to just scoot by. And that feeling of that's OJ's hand.
I was in a sushi bar once. It was right after the trial, and he was a free man. And we were my three daughters and I, and they'd been watching the news with me. We'd all seen a lot, and he was there with a date. And I told them that in this sushi bar, he had killed all the fish. And I got a laugh from the oldest. The other two looked at me like, "What are you gonna do to me, Dad? This is really bad. You're gonna mess up my mind." Brian, I just watched your new special on the Rocks, and it's out tomorrow, actually. That's when this is coming out, this pod.
Okay.
So it is, I don't want to say one your best, but I mean, you're always great, but it's really great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, you're so voluminous, not in metric weight, but I'm saying how you're prolific. Was that, how long did you roll that set? Or, I mean, just walk me through it.
Well, I had a two special deal with Netflix. This is the second of the two. The first special came out, I don't know, 3 years ago?
Yeah,
something like that. Thank you. So once that comes out, you know, I start the process of trying to come up with a new hour, you know? I always say there's three simultaneous goals. There's the individual jokes, a bit, and then there's the 5-minute spots, you know, for Letterman or Fallon or something like that. Those are a different animal. And then there's the hour goal. So all of those are happening at the same time. But this hour started about 3 years ago.
That makes sense. I'm on like a 4-hour. I'm on a 4-hour podcast. No, I'm on a 4-year between specials trajectory. I know for a fact that you will do a special and you'll shoot like half the material is different than the other set. We shoot two in one night is how you do it. But you're pretty prolific. What do you think you credit that to?
Well,
I hate that. That sounded like an interviewer question, because in your stand-up, you're constantly talking and you have the greatest dumb person character, which you are one of them sometimes.
You're right.
But you're learned. You're a learned man.
Thank you.
And you love words.
I appreciate that. I like to think that the comedy is coming from two perspectives. It's from a guy who feels uncomfortable and inadequate and insecure, but that guy is also aware of the world and can see stupid behavior and I like both of those things happening within the comedy, and I hope it comes across that way. It always bugs me when people think it's just the dumb side. It's like, well, that's only half the joke.
Unfortunately, we're living in a time where people are exuding quite a bit of that persona, but you're being self-aware about it. That's what's so brilliant about it. You've always done that.
You.
Well, that's what a great stand-up is they look from the outside, so that you're giving the full view for sure.
Thanks, man. But to answer your earlier question, as far as prolific, which I appreciate, there was a time when I got lazy. And when I first started headlining and first started getting a little bit of a following, you know, I was in comedy clubs and I was like, wow, people are coming out to see me, which was very intriguing. And then, so the numbers went up, audience numbers, and then they started going down again. And I remember hearing comments after shows where people go, it's the same stuff, but it's funny every time. And like, they think that's a compliment, but to me, I'm like, wow, I don't want it to be the same stuff. So I realized that I needed to go back to when I first started doing comedy and go back to that fear of not knowing if something was going to get a laugh or not, and stop relying on the sure laughs, you know, throw those sure laughs out and go back to the drawing board. And that's when I started like really feeling like, okay, now I can come up with all kinds of stuff if I'm willing to try and willing to experiment, willing to fail, you know.
And once you get those sea legs, it becomes, I mean, I know that I go to clubs to work out stuff so that when I'm doing hard ticket gigs, I'm not screwing around. I'll put new stuff in a theater gig, but I understand that you'll put in like 10 minutes, 15 minutes of new stuff in a hard ticket gig,
And you sneak it in, you know, you bookend it with stuff that hopefully, you know, will work, and then put some other stuff in there that doesn't work. And I found, not by design, but I find that if an audience sees a joke not work, they're even more appreciative of the ones that do work than
right.
They, you know what I mean? Like they go, oh, everything isn't a home run. You know what I mean? And I feel like it's a win-win.
Do you do I do the Carson backpedal, Johnny Carson, not Carson Daly. You know, if something I'm trying doesn't go anywhere, I'll do the, you know, what Johnny did so well. Bill Maher actually does Johnny Carson. He admits it. You know, his stature and how if something doesn't work, he'll blame it on the writers or he'll maybe it wasn't there. You know, do you do that kind of thing sometimes?
Yeah. You know, I mean, like I'll have a couple of savers, you know, to get myself out of a bit that doesn't work. And my stuff is a little, you know, I'm not doing one-liners, you know, like I have to commit to a bit that's going to last 2 or 3 minutes long. And if it doesn't work, it's glaringly obvious. It isn't like, wow, that was a line and now I can just move on. So, you know, as long as I acknowledge it playfully, I'm fine. You know what I mean? Crowds will always give you a foul ball. They're willing to give you a foul ball.
Right, right. And people ask me, and I'm sure they ask you, when they don't understand what this is, you know, and I heard actually Bill Maher talk about it the other night. Do you ever bomb? And I would say, what's your answer to that?
Yes, yes.
Of recent, I mean, let's pre-pandemic.
No. I just did a private event about a week ago in front of a bunch of high rollers in a casino. I got the feeling within the first 30 seconds, they didn't really know who I was. And yeah, I mean, they were polite, but there's a difference between performing in front for me. If I'm performing in front of people who have an idea of who I am and what I do, or they've heard, hey, this guy's pretty funny, that's one kind of audience. But if I'm performing for people who are assembled for another reason, a corporate event, right, or a charity event, or it's a business meeting and they throw an entertainer on, right, if they're assembled for another reason other than me, it is a complete crapshoot how I'm going to do. I would bet against me. I bet against me in those situations.
They always say to me, because my act evolves, I'm a chameleon. You know, I could be clean as a whistle. And sometimes I just do what I do. I've always looked up to you for how amazingly funny you are.
Thank you.
It's not your voice to curse. And I only had a shock value time with one special. I had been trying to break out of a box for a while. And then I just cursed if it felt like it was there. It's just my vernacular. But you know, I'm telling you the truth. You're one of the best living stand-ups.
Man, thank you.
There's thousands of dead ones that are better than you.
I concur.
What was it like? You did a four episode thing with Jerry Seinfeld, right?
Yeah, well, he was kind enough. It was on Netflix. It was a 4-episode series called Stand Up and Away. And it was a hybrid of my stand up that would then segue into sketch. And Seinfeld was just kind enough to spearhead it for me. I mean, he could not have been a better executive producer. Like, he likes my stuff, which is a huge honor in and of itself. He said he felt I should have a TV show and he wanted to help me have one. I mean, that's better than gold, frankincense, and myrrh. I mean, what kind of gift is that?
Right.
So he and I went to Netflix and just used his clout to get me the 4-episode series. But he was cool enough to not be over-involved. Like, he wanted it to be my vision. He said, I'll weigh in and say certain things, but at the end of the day, I realize I'm talking with my hands way too much here.
No, it's perfect for this, because some people will look at it on YouTube. It's like Jeff Dunham to them.
I'm watching myself.
You know, you're a physical comedian.
No, I can't tell a story with that. Oh, really?
Yeah, I know. Anyway, you probably didn't know, but we'll get back to that.
So anyway, he spearheaded it for me and kind of let the vision be mine. And it was a huge honor that he helped get that going for me. You know, it's funny, the meeting, it's Jerry Seinfeld and me and Netflix people. And it was so comforting because no matter what they asked me, you know, like if they would go, all right, well, how do you see this show progressing? My answer could always just be, that's Jerry Seinfeld.
So you're just fawning the whole time.
That's all you need to know.
Can't get over it.
He wants to do this, so that's it. It's the end of the story, you know?
So what would you like to do? Not say no to Jerry.
Exactly.
Well, he did it with Colin Quinn. He directed, produced, because he knows the best people. And you truly are exceptional. And many people that are some very well known now are kind of, I'm sure you see them and go, wow, that's me, isn't it? That's a little bit of my way of functioning. We all got it from somewhere. I hate asking this. I sound like an old Steve Allen interview. Because I really want to know, because I see different shades of people in you, but what were your big influences? Let's do the whole thing. How did comedy first hit you? How old were you when you started? And were you in Miami, which is where you're from?
I grew up in Miami. I went to college in Ohio, small Midwestern school called Heidelberg College. I went there to play football and I thought to become an accountant. And after 1 year of economics, I switched majors to communication theater arts. And it was in that world, I started doing plays and public speaking and that sort of thing. And that's when I hit on that crazy notion of, I wonder if I could be a comedian. Like it was so fascinating to even have the thought, you know,
what year was that?
I was supposed to graduate in 1980. So it was around 79, 80 when I first started having these ideas.
And that's when the comedy boom started. That's when I got to the Comedy Store, and that's when it really was rock and roll.
I got so fortunate. When I first decided to be a comedian, comedy had not quite yet exploded. Comedy clubs were still in New York and LA. So I was planning to move to New York. I had to pick one of the two cities. That was my plan. I go back down to Miami, and in the Miami Herald, there's an ad for the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was a sister club to the one in New York City.
Hell yeah.
And it said open mic night on Monday night. I haven't come across an ad in my life that has changed me so much. Like I was like, I can get there with a tank of gas. Like I was planning to have to move to New York. And I'm like, I just got to get a tank of gas and I could get from Miami to Fort Lauderdale and do this open mic thing. And that's that's how I got into the comedy club world.
How long were you there working out at that club?
I auditioned there 5 times. When I passed my auditions, they let me go on every night. And I was there for about 2.5 years. I went on almost every single night for 2.5 years before I then decided to go out on the road. And that's when comedy started exploding around the country. Clubs started opening in all of these cities. And I was so fortunate that I was able to work every week, not because I was any good. All these clubs needed comedians. If you could stand on stage for 30 minutes and not melt, you could get booked. And so I just took advantage of that.
I got to go back to the special that's out right now, starting tomorrow, or whenever you're listening, this is probably out right now. But you do something that you do address incredibly serious stuff. You do it in the whole at a party conversation thing with people. You're talking about people that are just saying nothing. That drives you crazy. And then, you talk about basically you get to the death penalty. I mean, you talk about, you know, crimes, you veil things in a general way, but it's so cool how you do it. Cause you hit some hardcore topics, but you wouldn't know it cause you're so likable and real about it.
Yeah. I appreciate it, man. I like to talk about mundane stuff, but then I also like to hit with some real stuff and have it be a little bit of everything, you know. I love being able to, like, the crime stuff. I really am proud of that, you know. I like to talk about stuff like that, and you know, it might be surprising to some listeners to go, I thought he talked about donut sprinkles, right? Which I do, but I also like to talk about the death penalty.
I mean, most comedians are dark off. They're dark off stage. You know, they get depressed and stuff, and they get upset with what's going on in the world. But anybody from right or left or in between can watch, especially all of your stand up. See you live if they're lucky enough, or watch your specials, which you've done 7. One was a DVD, and one was recorded, and the other five were full-on film specials, right? Am I right?
I have eight. I have this thing I just did on the rocks that we're talking about is the eighth 1 hour that's out there. A lot of them have been specials. One was a self-produced DVD. One was a self-produced CD. So they're not all specials, but I have eight different hours of material that.
Well, our publicist, Michael O'Brien, who is one of the meanest people I've ever met in my life, who's 9'5", he told me seven. He told me seven. And I went,
well, what? He's fired.
That's what this is about. Let's get him run out of town. So do you yell at the news? What goes on when no one's watching this delightful guy that wants to entertain as many people as possible?
It's a very good question, because with stand-up comedy, you have a microphone and an ability to share things with people, but it's a constant internal debate as to how much to decide, how much to share and how much not to share. Because I do have thoughts and beliefs and that sort of thing. And I like to hint at them or sneak them in a little bit, but I don't like to overexpose where I'm coming from as an individual. I try to be a little cagey with it. You know, right. I try to do the jokes that both sides would think I'm on their side. You know, you go, oh, he believes what we believe. And the other side goes, oh, he believes what we believe. But yeah, I've got feelings about current stuff, but I try to kind of stand on the sideline in terms of jumping into the cauldron of everybody shooting fireballs at each other, you know?
Well, that whole thing, you just lose the comedy. There's not a lot of, I mean, I'm a Twitter guy, I'm on Instagram, and the things that people are finding funny are just, you know, basically running old America's Funniest Home Videos clips, you know, just running that, and once in a while a TikTok, but a lot of the time it's just anger toward politics and the world, and you're needed so bad.
I always feel like I am such a bad interviewee. Like I love getting on stage and being able to share things that I've been able to put scaffolding around and come up with a beginning, middle, and an end. But when I'm being interviewed, I like being interviewed by comedians because they kind of get it. But people outside of that world, like, I feel like I'm the lamest. Like I feel like if somebody were watching me, they would go, not only are we not going to buy a ticket to see this guy, we have to call our friends who have tickets and tell them to cancel.
I wouldn't. That's not my takeaway here. This is more of a conversation, though.
So no, I'm enjoying this. I'm
just saying. You're coming off well. People are going to buy tickets, and you're back out. Am I right?
Yeah,
you were going back out to half capacity places for safety now, soon, right?
Yes. Well, I only sell half capacity to begin with, but now it looks like, hey, this place would have been full, but I can't blame it. There's a pandemic. I'm out. Yeah, I've been playing the half capacity comedy clubs and some outdoor venues. I did two drive-in movie theater things, which might be the last two I'll do in this lifetime.
What was your experience with that? Because I was going to do one, but right when I was going to do it, the hospital capacity in the California and Orange County area was 115%. So there was no way to get in. And I went, what if, you know, 400 cars are there and one of them gets in an accident coming to see me and they can't get in the hospital? I caused that. So that's how far neurotic I went. And so what was the drive-in experience like?
The first one I did, I got on, I forget how many cars were there. And not people were in their cars, but people were also out of their cars, you know, sitting in lawn chairs and stuff like that. But it was so spread out and people were so far away that my biggest, strongest laughs sounded like this. I'm not joking. Like that was it. And then 75% of my stuff was getting, from my perspective, silence. There were people who were walking around who said, no, people are enjoying it. They were at their,
That's what you want. No, people are enjoying it.
While I'm on stage, it was like a science experiment where I'm like, all right, I just have to try to pretend like I'm doing well and just see if I can give it the timing and the energy and the pauses that this comedy is supposed to have in a void, in a vacuum. And so I enjoyed it in a weird way because it was so bizarre. But, you know, comedy ultimately is about laughs. And if you take that away from the equation, I mean, talk about sucking the fun out of it for a performer, you know?
So this show that you did, that your special, that was shot pre-quarantine, correct?
No. It was shot in October of this last year.
Our publicist, Michael O'Brien.
We got to get him on the phone and let him know what's going on.
It looked full in the audience.
It was shot in Ivins, Utah, at an outdoor amphitheater. Everybody in the audience has masks on. You can't, they tried to shoot around it, but like if you look, you can see that. That area of the country was the least infected area, or one of the least infected areas in the country in terms of COVID. And then even with that, they had all kinds of protocols involved for us backstage and for the audience. And, that was shot, in October.
That's amazing to me.
So it was, I'm just happy that I was able to get a special out during these times, because most people that are doing specials have to do these unusual venues and,
right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, I wanted this to look like it was a special that had nothing to do with COVID. You know, that you
accomplished that. I mean, you mentioned it, and you also talk about, and it's in the promo, so I'm not going to be teasing your hair, but you do mention that you stopped the coloring, and then an amazingly hilarious observation of you buying hair dye, or how guys do. It's all so refined. Every piece of material you've always done. That's why I just love watching you. It's so.
Thank you.
Do you write it down? How does it function? Do you get up in the morning and do what a writer does, or do you do what I do, which is you get an idea, write it down, and then think of where would this go, and then what's your process?
I'm not good at sitting down and creating comedy. I just don't know how to do it. I've tried to sit at a keyboard. I've tried to sit at a blank piece of paper and me for an hour equals a blank piece of paper. Like nothing's coming out of me. I have to go. And I just learned that for me, I'm just do what I would normally do. I walk where I would normally walk. I watch what I would normally watch. And then every once in a while, you see something in a weird way and you go, hey, that could be a bit. And then you write it down. And then I'll have a version of it in my head. And then I hit the stage. I tape every show. And I find a lot of the best writing takes place on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out in the moment how to get at it, you know?
That's how I've heard most people do it. I know Jerry is meticulous about writing, even by his book that he had with all of the jokes from the beginning until the present. It's there. I mean, it's in print. And I know you work a bit in your head. Will you wrestle with it for like a long period of time? Just like, and that's what I do. I'll keep trying to get there with it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, to me, I love the process, you know. I mean, it sounds cliche or whatever, but it's like, the initial idea is one thing. It's like, okay, this is a funny idea. And then I love that night after night thing of trying to figure out the best way to convey it. The lottery number bit.
No, you know? My God, everybody, the lottery number bit. Okay. It's Brian Regan on the Rocks, Netflix, the lottery number bit. I've never heard anything like it. I didn't know you were, you proved you were OCD. It's so great. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, thank you. I like the bit because it's not an exaggeration. I've been around people who have told that very story, telling me the numbers that they picked. Like, how can you possibly think this is an entertaining tale? But in the performance aspect of it, it's kind of a dangerous bit in that if people aren't riding the silliness from Jump Street, it's a long way to go. It's just a guy telling his lottery ticket numbers. So I had to put some comedy helper in there. After the two tickets, I had to put in a little moment where it comes back to me going, this is the story this guy's telling. Just a little, get him back on track. And so I do one ticket, two tickets, and then I had to interject that moment, and then third ticket and fourth ticket. So it's little things like that where I used to just do all four tickets, and every once in a while an audience would like, okay, we get it already. So, but you learn that from doing it night after night, you know, it's like, okay, this needs a little help here. This needs a boost here. Drop this moment or add this moment. I love that. I love learning things like that night after night.
Yeah. And it adds, it's theatrical to be able to do that. It's, you know, it's like a lot of plays have, you know, the stage manager from Our Town. I'm sure I lost everybody with that reference, but you know, you look to the audience and you explain, you're in the middle of talking to these guys.
Right.
It's an acting piece, really, which I wanted to segue quickly, that you have played Muggsy, a recovering addict who is estranged from his family in the Peter Farrelly TV series, Loudermilk, starring Ron Livingston. And Peter just called you out of the blue. How did that come about?
He saw me perform at Lucy Fest, you know, in, I forget the city, the western state of New York. There's a comedy festival. Anyway, he saw me perform there. Jackie Flynn, friend of mine, comedian, knows Peter Farrelly, brought him to my show. And then after the show, Peter Farrelly said he was working on this TV series and wanted to know if I'd want to be in it. And I said, well, I don't know if I know how to act, you know? I said, I've never been in anything. And he said, no, you know how to act. And I'm like, well, how do you know that? And he goes, well, I just saw your show. And he goes, everything you're doing is acting. You just have to take what you're doing and put it into a character. And so that kind of threw me, you know, I was like, wow, okay. So anyway, he cast me in this show, and we're hoping it lands in a new platform. Two seasons have aired. The third season has been shot, and I'm proud to be in it. And let's see if it lands.
I saw
somewhere.
Some of it. You're really good. I mean,
thank you.
You're clearly an actor. I mean, just when you're having conversations in all of your stand-up all these years, you know, to have that other person who's very articulate, have someone who's not as articulate, for you to be self-aware about your own self-effacing ignorance, and then also, you know, when you make that face, I'm gone. When you, where does that come from? Does that just come from being out in the world and you see millions of people that act like that?
I don't know. The dumb fantasy guy, me feeling dumb, I like to, you know, exaggerate it as much as possible, and it just feels goofy. I don't know where it comes from.
It's wonderful. I mean, Bill Burr must have, you know, he's so brilliant, and I would think he would be influenced by you just by, I mean, he's an original voice, of course, but I mean, he does the thing where he's always doing the voice of cancel culture. It's like, you know, but you just said that you're, you know, why why'd you say that? And he's always too a whiny, angry guy. You've got the same, you have this voice, this inner conscience.
No, I appreciate it. I didn't realize until, I don't know, when I was new to the road, I decided, hey, I better like put some effort into this craft, you know? So I was trying to script out my act. It's like, I'm going to script out all my jokes. And while I was doing it, I realized these are mostly vignettes. They're not jokes. They're scenes.
Yeah.
It's me and an eye doctor. It's me and a flight attendant. It's me and an inanimate object. It's me and an ironing board. It's me and a microwave oven. There are moments, you know, that are funny. And so I have to, for it to work, I have to act it out. You know what I mean? And so it's fun to do.
You know what's fun to do is to take a break. So we're going to be right back. We're back. And that was fast, wasn't it?
I enjoyed that break.
I just bought a mattress and I manscaped. It was unbelievable. So who are your influences? Because what you described right before the break was some of our greatest comedians that ever lived. Bob Newhart would always be him in a circumstance at the dentist. Who would you say influenced you the most when you're in Miami? Were you watching TV with your dad, mom?
When I was young, I mean, I always enjoyed comedy as a fan, but I never dreamed I would go in that direction, you know. But some of the names are the obvious names, like Richard Pryor. I just love watching Richard Pryor. In fact, I watched one of his specials recently. It came on HBO. And I was watching it, and I literally, sound corny, I started crying, like, emotionally, because I was watching art done at a magnificent level. And it's like, you know, it's like, I like to think, wow, I like doing stand-up comedy. And to watch somebody like him do it in such a beautiful, pure way, and talk about revealing, you know, it's nice to watch somebody do it at a level that is like through the roof. So I used to love watching him. George Carlin, for his, you know, work ethic and how much stuff he put out there. I read both of his books, George Carlin's Brain Droppings and with Napalm and Silly Putty. It's the only books I've ever read where I was literally laughing, you know, hard while I'm reading a book. And it's like, because I could hear his voice in the words. And I was always a big fan of Steve Martin's stand-up comedy.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about. Because, by the way, those are the three people I see when I'm looking at you.
Wow.
I see the characters, because Richard would go into the characters. He would just be gone. But his was, of course, his experience is different than yours. He'd be a junkie or, you know, and then he would snap out of it and talk to the audience. And Steve Martin that's where the physical comes from. Cause I talked to you earlier and said, you're physical. And you went like, you know, you weren't sure for a moment, but his whole thing was always fluid movement.
Yes.
You know,
and silly. It's silly and smart, double barrel. Like,
amen.
His character was ridiculously goofy, but the comedian was incredibly smart. And so I'm laughing at both those things. I'm laughing at the character, but I'm laughing at the comedian. I always think like buffoonery without smarts is just dull. You know what I mean? Just like a goof. You want there to be some smarts to it. And Steve Martin had a force of smartness to the silliness. And I just always got a big kick out of him. I wish he would do stand-up again. I really do. But
well, it's interesting because I know that when he was out touring doing the bluegrass thing, I talked to someone who said, well, there's like 12 minutes of stand-up. If you shake the tree and just take out his talking to the audience, and then him and Marty kind of have those moments, you know, when they go out and tour and they're doing a show together, which is really cool. But he's probably one of the greatest that has ever lived also. And then Carlin, what's different about you that I love so much is that you can get the poignancy out and you're not angry, Brian. So why are you not angry? I mean, I don't exude anger on stage either, unless someone says something that's wrong to say in a room full of people to me, which I expect once I go out touring again will happen because people are... Have you had disgruntled people lately?
Yeah, I have a lot of difficulty if somebody yells something mean-spirited. It doesn't happen that often, you know, but sometimes people, you know, we all deal with hecklers and stuff like that. If I ever have to cross that line into being a disciplinarian from the stage, it's very, very hard to go back over that line to, hey, it's me again. Because the audience just, they realize we just saw some anger there. It's kind of hard for us to forget that. Whereas, you know, a lot of comedians who are acerbic to begin with in their point of view can drill a heckler and then get right back. It's not, the tone is no different. But for me, it's disarming to have to discipline a crowd from the stage. You know, it's very frustrating.
And then you have to go into power mode and it changes the energy of what you do after that.
Right. Right.
I've had a bunch of that. But I am equipped, as you know, from history right now with Jewish lasers. So I'm able to stun them.
Wow.
Because I have one in my eyes.
I'm in the market. I'll be happy to purchase one or two.
Now, have you been COVIDed? Do you go to the market?
I had COVID. I got the COVID.
Oh, I did know that from our wonderful publicist, Michael O'Brien.
He knows everything.
He does. He does. When did you get it?
I got it in December.
Do you know how you got it?
No idea. I mean,
so you weren't laying in a Home Depot on the ground with your mouth open.
Well, I do that anyway, but I didn't realize that was a way to catch COVID. I was supposed to do shows in Florida. I was going to be flying on a red eye, took a rapid test during the day, and then got the results like 7 o'clock at night. And it was sort of like, wow, okay. So we had to do the whole public relations thing, get the social media out that I had to cancel that weekend's shows and, you know. And then I had no symptoms whatsoever, though. That it was when I got it, like that night, I smoked a cigar and drank wine. I'm like, this is the weirdest sickness ever. You know, like, I'm sick. Okay. You know. And then a few days later, I started getting a slight cough, and then it got worse and worse and worse. And like, I got it pretty rough, actually. You know, I didn't have to go to the hospital or anything like that, but it was pretty intense, and I don't wish it on anyone.
Well, really?
That would be a weird wish.
That would be. Well, people did wish it on some people. I guess people that didn't believe in COVID. But you can't wish ill on people. That's a very hard way to look at things now, because that's not where a lot of people are coming from. Mm. I need to get out and do stand-up. I need to be in contact with people, because I want COVID also.
I got the perfect places. I'll give you my tour schedule and then just repeat it, and you'll probably end up with it.
I will. And all my pauses, I'll just have my mouth open. I'll just, you know, instead of keeping it closed and strutting. I noticed a lot in this special on the rocks, what's great is you're not aware of it, because some people plan to move. You know, they should be accountants rather than just follow their natural way of doing their performance. But you, and I've learned it over 40 years of stand-up, that you walk the stage, you figure out when it's a good time to move, when you want to, and it doesn't always stay the same, but right. You're very physical. You really do act things out with your hands, with your way you motion, your body changes as an actor when you turn. Just can you do a dumb person talking to me just for a minute? I'm not asking you to.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know if I can duplicate it. Let me
ask you a question. Is it you as a dumb person, or is it just somebody that? Oh, this is a guy that I'm talking to. A guy that went to go see Brian Regan's show. What were your reactions? Did you like it, sir?
I thought it was really funny, but some of the stuff was like way over my head.
See, so now that's a compliment. You're not taking this. This guy's admitting his shortcomings. I don't think people always say that. That's sweet. There's no anger in that guy. He's admitting that he's
just a good guy.
He's a good guy. He just doesn't have all the stuff that it would take to get all of your stuff. So now you are gonna, touring's your favorite thing, right? One of them.
I like being on stage doing the comedy. I don't like, going to the airport and looking up and finding out that your flight is canceled.
Yeah.
And then you got to deal with, that whole deal. I remember when I first started working with my manager, Rory Rosegarten, who's great.
He's my friend. I've loved him forever.
Rory is great. So we were, I was a new client to him, and I was living in New York at the time. I was at LaGuardia and I was supposed to fly to some gig, and they canceled the flight. And there was a mob scene around the desk of everybody trying to like rebook their flights and get on other airlines and that sort of thing. So I called Rory. This was before payphones. I called Rory and I said, "Hey, listen, I'm at the gate and they just canceled the flight. There's a mob scene around the gate." And so he goes, "Brian, here's what I need." He knew me a little bit. He goes, "Here's what I need you to do. I want you to hang up this phone. I want you to walk to the front of that line. You walk in front of everybody. I want you to walk up to that reservationist and I want you to say, 'I am a performer and I have a show that I have to be at tomorrow night. You need to book me on the next flight immediately.'" And I said, "Rory, I'm going home." And he said, "Okay."
So much for the aggressive attitude that he would have done.
Yeah, I mean that's something you're comfortable with, Rory, not right. me. Right. I'm sure there are people that have more pressing reasons to get to where this flight was supposed to go than me. I have a show I have to do.
Right, I'm needed in Calgary.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've played the most hallowed venues in the U.S. All of them, basically, right? Radio City, Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
Have you
Red
played
Rocks, the Red Rocks Amphitheater outside of Denver? That was amazing.
What a beautiful place.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what other Kennedy Center in Washington. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to be able to, walk on stage. You see the signatures on the wall of all these like amazing artists that have performed in these places. And, you look in a mirror and go, "What the hell? How did this happen? How did this happen that I'm going out on that stage?" I still wonder sometimes.
Well, Mike, I have two questions. One, I'll finish with the venues. What was the... Are they all a dream? Is it all like the best date ever in a person's life? Or is there one place or show or a couple shows that stand out to be like, "Holy crap, I can't believe this"?
Well, it's hard not to, to do Radio City or to do Carnegie Hall. It's hard not to realize the magnitude of it, to go, "Man, these places are iconic." Like everybody, you could go into the Amazon jungle and go up to people who have never been contacted before and go, what's the most famous venue? They go, Radio City, you know? Well, I perform there. Ah, really? All right, we won't shoot a blow dart into you. So yeah, it's amazing and it's humbling, you know. It's all that.
I think it's because, and I know you don't want to praise yourself, but you work your ass off, right? I mean, you're always. Is it a strong work ethic that was instilled? Because it sounds like from what you were saying earlier that you acquired it after you realized, I don't want to keep doing the same stuff every night. I don't want to be that
Correct.
Guy.
Correct. Yeah. Like I worked up until that point, but in terms of, hey, I want to get out there and get booked in clubs and that sort of thing. But I forgot about the comedy part of it and the creating part of it. And then when I realized, oh, wait a second, let's bring that back into the equation. Then I've worked on all of that. I mean, I do like to work, but I also have these, I'm going to be done fantasies, you know, like, I like the idea of not having to work. Jerry Seinfeld thinks comedians can't retire. He's like, no, comedians have to do comedy until they die.
I agree.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of going, all right, I did a body of work and now I want to learn how to fly fish and I'm done. You know, I don't know if I'll ever get to that point, but maybe.
But you do get so much love from the craft. I mean, it's like, I was seeing Don Rickles in a wheelchair, and on stage sitting in a chair. And it was still hilarious. You went to pay tribute to the man. And Bob Newhart will do an occasional gig. Mel Brooks does a talk back. You know, he'll sit and have someone interview him, and then he does little bits in between. It's fun to watch that. I mean, I can't see you stopping.
Marty Allen? Marty Allen?
I've met him. I don't know him.
I mean, he passed away, but a few of us went to go watch him perform in Las Vegas, a very small venue. This is like, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, maybe longer than that. And we had a little front table, a little cozy little Vegas nightclub. And he came out on stage in his tuxedo, older guy. And he was getting laughs. And I mean, I'm sitting right underneath him. And I could see the twinkle in his eye, like he was loving every minute of it. And this is contradictory to what I was saying before about retiring, but it made me feel like it was very comforting to me. Like, so maybe I could just enjoy doing this forever. You know, like this guy is an older guy. He's probably in his late 70s or something. And he's still on stage getting laughs and enjoying the hell out of it. And it was very comforting and rewarding to be able to watch that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want you to retire just because you're going to have more perspectives. You have a lot of good. I have a lot of medical material. It happens as we get older. We just, there's no one that doesn't have something about a colonoscopy or, you know, just it right. Hits you, you know. But, I mean, it'd be really fun to watch you decay and do material about
you know, Johnny Carson, when he retired, one of the few interviews that he did, somebody asked him, you know, what's it like being retired? And he said, for the most part, he likes it. But the hardest thing for him was thinking of something funny during the day and realizing that he didn't have a stage that night to say it on. And I was like, okay, that could prevent me from retiring because, you know, when you think of something, like I always know if I think of something, I can do something with it. I can write it down and do it in a show somewhere. But what if I'm done? Then what, you know?
Is that one of your fears? That you feel like you're going to run out? Because you literally seem like a never-ending waterfall of material. I couldn't come up with a better word than waterfall. I was thinking of your bit where you turned the sink on. Look, we have water.
No, I mean, I always tend to think of things, but my fear is if I do choose to retire, that things I think of after retirement day won't have, I won't have an ability to share them anymore.
Yeah.
That's the fear.
Johnny Carson was very nice to me, and I was on his show one time, and it was a commercial break, and he said, "I'm sorry the audience wasn't good tonight." And I was just a panel guy because I never did stand up on the show, but I was frequent as being panel with him. And he said, "Sorry that they weren't good." I said, "They seemed really good to me." He says, "They're not good." And I said, "Well, what do you do when the audience isn't good?" He goes, "There's always tomorrow." And so then the thought is, well, what if there isn't a tomorrow? Because he retired, and
right.
From what I heard, it was, you know, he'd lost his son. It was a hard disengagement from this amazing. I mean, there was only one Johnny Carson. No one will ever command that big an audience on TV.
I used to love watching him. Even before I had any inkling of being a stand-up comedian, I just, you know, when I could stay up late and watch him do a monologue and the way he interviewed people, he's very smart. Like, he knew a lot about a lot of things. He could interview authors and, you know, scientists and, you know, and all of the interviews were smart and engaging, and yet he could be very funny. And he didn't get laughs at the guest's expense, you know. The story I love to tell is the little old lady with the potato chip collection. And it would have been so easy to mock. It would have been so easy to mock this woman, but she came out with her potato chip collection. She thought all these potato chips looked like different things.
Yeah, I remember.
And he got laughs because it's a silly hobby, but he didn't make her look stupid. You know, he made her look like a queen. And I just loved that approach. Like, that woman didn't have to go back to her hometown and be embarrassed and go, "Wow, that guy really made fun of you the other night." I like that win-win kind of comedy. You know, it was like so beautiful to watch him be nice to that woman.
Me too. And I miss it sometimes. It's up with people kind of thing.
Yeah.
But we have it. I mean, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert, they don't usually make fun of people that they have on. You know, they don't really have a lot of civilians on. That's what was also unique about Johnny. He would have just a nice lady with someone quirky or someone they'd read about, and he put him on first. You know, now you open with Tom Cruise, you know. But
right. Johnny. Who's got three surefire anecdotes that are already pre-planned. Like, everything is bam, 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 you know.
Yeah, and Tom Cruise, you know, he's going to yell at you if you don't, you know, follow COVID restrictions. We're going to do one more break just for cleanup at the last segment. Okay. But I could talk to you all day, but I know you're busy because you're promoting the hell out of this amazing special. So we'll be right back, probably something for mattresses or therapy. We're back. They probably just heard something about mattresses or therapy. I don't know. And they go together.
Yeah.
Have you ever had therapy? Is that too personal? You don't have to answer.
Oh, I have. Yeah, sure.
Same.
Yeah. A car needs a tune-up. Why not a brain? Mm-hmm. Why not have somebody smarter than me say, "Hey, maybe you should consider looking at it this way or that way." I see nothing wrong with letting somebody guide you to better places.
Yeah. You work out your body. You want to work on different parts of yourself. A lot of people poo-poo it. They don't want to go in and, "I don't need it. I'm just fine." And a lot of times I think that they're doing themselves a disservice, because we all have pressure. We all have pain. And that's why you can't quit doing stand-up ever. Even if your acting career and you got a great series, because I have a feeling that this show is going to come back. Loudermilk. There's
some good words about it. I think so too. But thank you.
Yeah, and you're going to do more acting work because you're really gifted. That's why you don't. It was funny. I was talking to Bill Burr, and I turned 65 this year, and I said to Bill, "Thank you. How old are you?"
62.
No, you're a baby.
62. Reminds me of Rodney Dangerfield on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And Johnny goes, how old are you, Rodney? I'm 61, but all the broads think I'm 60.
That's how he got action. That's a statue of him right there. I got it from the UCLA. And that's a picture of him with Red Fox right there.
Yeah, he's...
He was a friend. He was
so great. Yeah. So great.
And that's the one-liner. There aren't stories. You can do both. I mean, you can throw in one-liners usually they're in the middle of a story with you, you know, but you do the creative thing that Carlin always did so well. And a lot of people do that are really, really good, which is you don't do a callback for the hell of it. You do it because it's just a thing that's synchronicity. It just happens perfectly to bring something back from 40 minutes before or 4 minutes before.
Yeah, thanks. I always find it interesting when comedians like have a line for another comedian. You know, they'll watch your show and they'll go, "Hey, I got a line for you." And you go, "Hey, what's that?" And then they tell you your line. You go, "You can say it. Say it after you say that."
Like, yeah.
Okay, so you're giving me my line. That's very nice of you. Thank you.
You're just saying repeat it. Okay, I understand. I understand callbacks.
Say it again later.
Oh, that's wow. Will you write for me?
All right, I'll say it again later.
And then there's the person that says to you, "You'll say I had a great time off," and their punch up will be, "Why don't you say vacation?" You know, it's just a lot of writers, they just give you synonyms. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, that is another way of saying that.
Yeah, so how does that change the joke? Well, it's alliteration or it has a C in it, you know.
Okay.
K's are funny.
I'll throw it in.
So now you're going to spend the rest of this year touring is the plan, depending on whatever acting stuff happens, right?
Yeah.
And they would go to brianregan.com?
They could go there. Yeah.
Where Brian else Regan could they go? You can go straight to hell.
that's my Instagram page. Go to hell. It's called Straight to Hell.
I don't
want my tour schedule on Straight to Hell.
That'd be good to have that as the very last gig.
Yeah, right.
You just have it fixed there. It's not part of your schedule. But it's
and go, "Oh, wait," at the bottom, he goes straight to hell.
Infinity.
brianregan.com, and then the normal Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, all that
people
stuff.
People have to see you. I'm telling you guys, if you have not seen Brian Regan live, everybody, literally everybody. Do you get kids at your shows?
Sometimes. Well, thank you, by the way, for saying that. It's very nice.
I'm just telling the truth. I mean, honest to God, I mean, you're, for a lot of people, you're one of the holy grails of, if you want to be a good comedian, watch Brian Regan.
Then
do his stuff verbatim and do callbacks.
Yeah. As far as the kids, you know, when I was doing comedy clubs, there were never any kids in the audience. Right. And then when I first started doing like theaters, I realized, you know, people said, you know, there's like some 12-year-olds out there. And I'm like, really? So I've always resisted, like, I don't want people thinking it's a kiddie show though. You know what I mean? Like,
it's not at all.
Yeah. It's like, I don't mind if people bring teenagers or a 10-year-old or something, but I'm not twisting balloon animals. You know, it's like there are going to be a lot of things that they're not going to get. They're not going to be, a kid is not going to be offended by anything that I do, but they're not going to get everything that I do.
And what about, have people, when you've done interviews in the past, have they grouped you in and gone, "He's one of the few good, clean comedians"? Have they tried to do that to you?
Yes, it's always a challenging thing. That word is such a double-edged sword to me. Double-edged sword. Is that the expression? Sword?
Yes, a sword.
Sword. Do you say the W? Sword?
When I'm in the fjords.
You ever buy? There's a company called Fjord Sword.
Yeah, they're swords from the fjords.
Swords from the fjords. They're great swords.
I think the Swedish cooking chef from the Muppets originated it. Whatever his name was.
I forget what I was saying.
It doesn't matter. About clean labeling, because I get labeled as being dirty, and then I go, well, I depends on the show. I mean, I do what I find funny. It really is a bunch of wiener jokes, you know? It's really like I'm 10. I don't do as graphic as, I mean, The Aristocrats was probably what skewed people to think that I'm just a filthy fishmonger. But I don't like that label because I also like doing family comedy, which doesn't sound safe. It sounds like stranger danger. But when you get labeled the clean thing, what is that? Does it get your back up?
Yeah, I know it shouldn't, but I find the term diminishing. I find it to be like they're putting me on the sideline. It's like, well, he's a funny, clean comedian. And it's like, I'd rather just be a funny comedian.
Yeah.
I like to work clean, but, I'd like to think can make anybody laugh. And
that's the gift you have. It's unbelievable. It's such a, to be able to talk to literally anybody.
Well, thank you. And it's been something I've fought my whole career. Like Michael O'Brien, he knows that we don't put clean in any of our press stuff. But like if I do a newspaper interview, it's amazing to me. I'll do the whole interview and like usually they'll bring up the clean thing. And if they don't, it's like, okay, great. But the headline, clean comedian Brian Regan coming to such and such. It's like, why do you have to put that? I find just put comedian.
You gained 200 more audience members and lost 50.
Or 300. I might have lost 300. You know, like, who knows? A lot of people don't want to go watch a clean comedian. Whereas no, they if they didn't know,
lose, right?
Yeah. If they don't know one way or the other, I'd like to think they'd come and have a good time. But if they saw a headline, clean comedian, they go, I don't want to go see this guy.
Right. Just when they say dirty or they say X-rated, I'm like, are you guys nuts? I'm South Park's dirtier than me if you dissect it, you know? So it's people love to pigeonhole you, which is a filthy thing to do. That's my comedy right there. You know, the innuendo of pigeonholing, that alone. That's me in a nutshell, which is another one.
That's X-rated, Bob. That's, you're doing X-rated stuff right now.
I'm so filthy. But it's like they want to do that because people don't realize that funny is just funny.
Yes.
And being who you are as an artist and as a human is who you are. And when I watch you, you know, it's, you could have cursed. It wasn't needed. It's not needed in what you're doing, but it's also you're tackling some mature subject matter that you have to be, at least have lived some life to understand what OCD is. And
that's why I don't do newborn baby shows anymore. Because I haven't lived enough life. Like I've tried them. I've done the newborn baby circuit and I'm walking around amongst the bassinets going, who here has OCD? And they don't even know words yet. You know what I mean? Like, like I feel like they don't even understand me.
They just hear a Peanuts cartoon, just the sound. But I've done a show with all women giving birth. And that, I got applause. I thought I was getting applause, but it was the doctor slapping the behind of the baby.
And you thought you were like on a roll.
I thought I was crushing.
And it was all the babies were born at the same time and all the slapping was happening. Yeah. And here you are thinking, wow, I really got them.
And then the crying and screaming, I thought were like people blowing like horns at a party at New Year's. I thought I was just killing. So Oh, I was going to tell you what Bill Burr told me. I don't know, 12 minutes ago, because I'm really an amazing interviewer. I just like talking to you. You know, that's why I love doing this podcast. So
you're nice.
You're nice. Don't you hate when
we're
you text?
Nice.
We're so great. When I text someone and I'll go, thank you. And they go, thank you in capital. And it just, the texting won't end. And you just to try to end it. You put a thumbs up.
Right. That's.
But not even, you have to attach it to theirs so they know this is almost over.
Here's something I thought of recently. I'm going to try to throw it in my act. But like when you're having a communication with somebody, you know, text communication or email communication, but you really don't want to hear from them again. You throw in, instead of, you throw in a whole season. Like, so you go, a good way to end it or to punt it is to go, hey, have a great summer. So that you're kind of hinting, I don't need to hear from you for 3 months.
Have a great decade.
Have a great decade. Hey, man.
Text me from a hospital. What I was going to say was, because you're 61, I'm 65.
And I'm 62.
You're young to me.
Whatever. Something like that. I think I'm 62.
I'm an excellent listener. So I said to Bill Burr, I haven't, and we were smoking cigars, and it was during quarantine, so I think we inhaled each other's non-COVID. And I said, you know, I haven't even done what I've come here to do, meaning work and movies and stand up and make a really good, be the best stand-up I've never been, make the best special I've never made kind of thing. Because I know I have it, what I want to do, and I was headed that direction. So I said, I haven't done what I've come here to do. And Bill looked at me and said, well, you better fucking hurry up. That was basically like telling me you're going to die. You've got a year.
Yeah, clock is ticking. That's funny.
Well, Brian, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I'm so happy to talk to you.
My pleasure, man. Thank you very much. It means a lot to me that you like what I do. I enjoy your humor very much as well.
My filthy
comedy.
Brand of.
I love all your dark, twisted, evil, X-rated, other side of the track jokes.
Don't forget hedonistic.
Hedonistic.
Sacrifices.
See that on a marquee. The hedonistic humor of Bob Saget.
They had this special about cursing, which is on Netflix, and I didn't want to do it because it's like that's just like reinforcing the label. And it was good. My friends were on it, and I was like, oh, maybe I should have done it. But it's like I didn't want to. I mean, George Carlin did it right by calling out those words, and it's almost like how many more versions of that do we need? He already perfected it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, I use those. Like, I'm not filthy, but I'm pretty dirty off stage, you know, with my friends and when I'm golfing and stuff like that. It's
right.
F this and F that. And people who see my comedy first and then see me in real life, I think they're a little surprised, you know, go, why are these words coming out of his mouth? You know,
it's I'm like, well, the opposite. That's the way
oh yeah. That's weird. You know,
I'm like, excuse me, you're in my parking space. You have a great confidence strut though. It's hilarious. Cause you're almost, that's what Steve Martin-ish to me, is that not at all copying him, but the fact that he had this cocky thing of, oh my God, not just I'm a rambling guy, but I'm just, he's so super cool. It's like the silliest James Bond.
And he's wonderfully funny.
But you have this other thing that is yours that is, that's what's so delightful because you know who you are and you know who you are on stage. And it's a real gift what you do. So don't stop doing it. Do it even up to your last breath. I want you to die on stage.
Okay.
At 102.
That's a nice wish.
And they'll just put you on a mic stand. It'll go up your ass and you'll just be like a scarecrow. Is that a sweet wish?
Yeah, that's a very sweet wish for me to die on stage.
Well, Brian, everybody needs to watch this special, and I'm going to talk about it after you're gone. I do an outro, so I'll keep talking about you. But be safe. Do you have any scarring? Do you have any COVID residual stuff? Or are you all back to health?
I think I'm back to 100%.
That means that you, it's unlikely you could get it right now, correct?
I think I'm in that window where I'm pretty safe. But I don't know. I want to get the vaccination, so I don't have to worry about it anymore. But yeah, I'm in that safety zone where I think you have a few months after you've had it where you probably can't get it again.
Yeah, I want to, they don't give them in the butt. And I think that's wrong. I think they, because you pull up in your car and you just stick your ass out the window and that's right. It. You got the shot.
Right. And then you go, oh, and then I've gotten tested a bunch of times.
Right.
The one where they stick the big long, there's one where you have to put the Q-tip in yourself.
Yes.
Like and they just keep saying, you know, no, further back, further back, further back, further back. And you're like, there is no further back.
It's your brain.
I'm as far as I can manage. If this needs to go further back, you need to put your hand on here and find a further back because I'm out of further backs. No, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit. Okay, there. Now twist it. Twist it.
I just think they want to see us tortured. And then they found out, as you know, months later, they just did the short swab. So you didn't have to, but because they all had all the old ones that were longer, they didn't want to, they didn't have the budget, so they just had to use them up.
Right.
There's no justice.
There's no justice. Well, so you pull up and just stick the butt out the window.
I pull up, put my butt out the window. They hit me with a shot. And then I kind of, I flatulate to say goodbye.
I tried that. I pulled up, I stuck my butt out the window and I heard, you know, this is the Burger King drive-through window, right?
I did the same thing and I ended up with a Whopper in my butt. And by the way, that was probably your experience when you were in a jail cell with OJ.
Yes. Yes, see, right.
That's a callback. You should use that from earlier, from something that you said. Yeah,
the thing you said earlier, say it later.
That's the key to comedy.
Come up with one funny thing and then just keep saying it.
Brian, thank you, man. And be safe out there and have a great, great continued tour. And everybody has to watch your special because it's called a special for a reason. I never knew that's why they call them a special because some are not special. I don't want to say who's there, who's are not, well, but people know. Yours is, all of your specials are, they're insanely good. And please don't ever stop and stay safe.
Thank you very much, Bob. Had a great time talking with you and hopefully we'll hook up again soon.
I would like that. And one day I'd like to go golf cursing with you.
Yeah, man. It'll be right after my very first tee shot. It won't be good. It won't be. I tend to top my tee shots. They go to the left into a bush and then some horrifically loud four-letter word comes out of me.
I will par a hole, and then the next hole I will lie 17. It's so sad, and I won't cheat, so you'll see me, you know, people just go, pick it up, we can't stand this anymore, Bob.
Put yourself out of this misery.
The ladies here with the hot dog cart. Oh, okay. Well, be well, stay safe, and I hope to see you in person so we can have some laughs at Michael O'Brien's expense.
At his expense.
Right?
Let's laugh at his expense.
One of the nicest people in my whole life.
All right, man. Thanks for everything, Bob. Thank you for all the incredibly kind words.
All sincere. Thank you, Brian.
Later, man. Bye.
See you. That is Brian Regan. And if you have not seen him, look at all of his specials. Listen to his LP. I think it's an LP. Or it was a CD back in the day. But he is so damn great. And it's a master class on stand-up. And it's not like it just comes out of him. And he knows how to do it. He's really one of the best. So you want to watch his special On the Rocks, which is on Netflix. And when you're listening to this today, it's out tomorrow, the 23rd. And if you're listening to it after that, right now, then it's on Netflix right now. And just go see him on tour. Bring your teenagers and your grandma. He is universal. He's just quite wonderful. It's refreshing for where we're at to see someone who it ain't a political show. It's an entertainment show, and he's doing what great comedians do, which is bring out things that we're thinking about, and be the outsider with observations, and give a little bit of himself and personal insight of who he is. So thanks to Brian Regan, and go see him. Go to brianregan.com and figure it out. Or as he said, you can find him on Instagram or anywhere. So what I want you to do, if you can, is, subscribe, and then you get to listen, but you just listened. So subscribe. You can download it. You can follow it. If that's how you get your stuff, you can watch it on the YouTube. You can rate, review. You want to do that and be positive. I can't take no more negative. I just can't. I mean, if I do something wrong, I'll own it. I swear. I'm trying not to talk too much, but it's a podcast. And then what else can I tell you? I'm going to call you guys at some point. So just look on Twitter or Instagram stories, and it'll say when I'm going to call you and see how you're doing. Be well. Take care of yourselves, and wishing you lots of good health as we get through this year, this next crazy year, and come out the other side. All the best, everybody.